Good evening, everyone.
I don't know what happened.
Nice wife.
Welcome to our
join the fun.
Public hearing on this, the 20th of May, to get your initial input on the draft of the Measure 91 implementation bill. Before we move into input, I want to just reiterate something that's really important, and that is that the 3400-1 was created in a way that can be very much adapted and shaped to reflect comments that we get from the public and learning and thinking that we do together in small groups and large groups over the next couple of weeks. So if you like it, if you hate it, if you still haven't read it, take heart that there is room for us to make modifications, and we fully intend to respond to input from stakeholders and community members and concerned citizens and concerned non-citizens. So welcome. Also, I wanted to give you a heads up of two things. Our good friend and co-chair, Senator Burdick, is under the weather, and so shout out to Senator Burdick. I hope you're feeling better. And two, our good colleague, Representative Helm, is having his 50th birthday today.
Ooh.
And nothing says happy birthday like a meeting from 5 to 7 right. with your colleagues. So we're going to really make it count for...
Make it short.
And then the third thing, I wanted to share that, for a sense of timing, we are really starting to run down the clock on the amount of time we have. And the Speaker of the House was suggesting that it would make a lot of sense to try to be aiming to work a bill by around the week of June 1st. And so I think that we need to, as we do comments and we have good ideas for things that could be added, we need to start really thinking about those in terms of what's feasible in the next couple of weeks and what things we should work in the interim for conversations in the short session. So our teamwork continues. I think this is a great group of people, and we're ready to hear from you. Anyone else have any opening comments you'd like to share? Okay, then. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3400-1. And I'm going to call to the front a couple of people who've signed up already. We're going to start with a panel that includes Seth Crawford, Elizabeth Remley, and Marianne Nash. And we'd like to have on deck Rob Bovet, Bo Whitney, and Patrick Moen, please.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, here with the Oregon Farm Bureau today. And had briefly reviewed the -1 amendments to House Bill 3400 and wanted to share some perspectives from kind of the agricultural side. First, we want to, one of our priorities in this process is just ensuring that marijuana is kind of on equal footing with other crops in Oregon. So for the provisions that deal with water rights and water uses, we would recommend ensuring that these uses are just complying with applicable law. So if it's in an urban area, water issued through the city, if it's in a rural area, that they have the appropriate permits from water resources to be engaging in that agricultural practice. And then some brief comments on the land use provisions as well, and that's section 35 for anybody reading along with me. So there's one piece where marijuana is defined as a crop for purposes of farming practice, as defined in ORS 30.930, commonly known as the right to farm statutes. And this is a bit of just a flag to raise. If you go to ORS 30.930 sub 2, a farming practice is defined as a practice that complies with applicable laws. And as you know, there's that federal state tension in regards to marijuana. And so that could create a conflict in terms of right to farm. And then more generally on the land use arena, I think the amendments need to more clearly address the relationship between the prohibition on county regulation outside of the time, place, and manner restrictions and the land use provisions. As you guys are aware, in farm use zones, there are certain uses that are outright permitted, and then there are certain uses, generally termed conditional uses, that require some amount of local governing body review, usually county review, before they're permitted. And I'm not clear from the existing language whether and to what extent counties can grant these conditional use permits for processing facilities and other activities conducted on the property, and whether and to what extent they actually can impose conditions on those uses consistent with DLCD's rules and with their local ordinances. And these amendments also predetermine how processing facilities are permitted under the conditional use process. And that's a little different than how existing agricultural uses are permitted. And I'm sorry, I know this is probably very boring to most people. For existing agricultural processing facilities, there's usually three provisions that they're permitted under. One is just a facility for processing farm crops. Another is commercial activities in conjunction with farm use. And the third is home occupations. And this kind of sets predetermined outcomes for primary processing and secondary processing. And our recommendation would be clarifying that county-state tension and then leaving the processing to existing county law, because it'll vary county by county how they like to do it, how they prefer to do it, and what will actually make sense for that operation. And we are kind of doing a little more digging after talking to Representative Hellman to how this is done for some other types of crops, so we can even maybe give a little more specific feedback in the future.
And thank you. And when you finish your comments, and I just wanted to note that probably we're going to ask people to keep their remarks to around 3 minutes each so that everyone has a chance to speak. But, you know, if you need to go over a little bit, that's okay. I'd love to invite Representative Helm to offer some input in response, if that would be helpful. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Great. And that was actually all of it. So
excellent.
With that,
thanks.
I'll conclude and ask for any questions.
Did you want to make a comment on that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just say for the committee, the portion of the land use section that deals with home occupations is a carryover from some very early conversations that we had with a group of stakeholders. And the idea there was, we already have primary processing on farmland. That's allowed for any crop, and it's just what you have to do with the crop when you bring it in immediately. It's allowed. There's not really any limitation on it. And then the thought was, well, if we're in the marijuana context and the same person, farmer, wants to both do that part and take it the next step, maybe to do an extraction process still on the same property, most counties would want some sort of knowledge that that's going on, and maybe some regulations around it. I've seen that happen through a home occupation before. We may not need that accommodation anymore because it may not really be wanted.
Okay.
And so I think we just ought to keep our minds open that if the farming community says we can do this through commercial use associated with agriculture, and that's the way they're most comfortable, let's go that way. If we hear something different from planning directors of the counties, we should take that into consideration.
Can we assume, Representative Helm, that you'll take the lead maybe, and I don't know, Senator Cruz, if you as a agricultural person would be interested in working kind of in a bipartisan team with Ken, but to help address these some of these land use issues. I think one of the game plans that we're hoping to implement, and I think Senator Burdick feels the same way, is probably have as much, you know, teamwork across chambers and in small groups to flesh out issues, you know, as efficiently as we can as we move forward trying to get a product by the end of session. So thank you. And Elizabeth, please go ahead and state your name and kick us off.
Hi, Chair Leininger and members of the committee. Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of the Association of Nurseries. I'm here to, in conjunction with what Marianne has said for the Farm Bureau, we agree that we'd like to see this growing community have some regulations around it that look a lot like what our regulations look like in the rest of the growing community in Oregon. And I think we understand that, practically speaking, we can't automatically start treating this new crop the way that we've treated every crop that's ever been grown in Oregon, because it's coming from a different place. But we think that eventually the Department of Ag probably will start regulating this crop the way that they regulate the other crops and plants that are grown in Oregon. So we want to see, we're interested in providing as much resource and information that you need to help figure out how, when this group of growers comes into the growing community, how we can all be getting along on the ground. That's essentially what we're interested in seeing. These folks are going to be our neighbors in our growing communities, and we want to welcome them, and we want to make sure that the farm practices that we follow translate to the farm practices that they follow. And that's everything from fertilizer use, pesticide use, ag and water quality, and even land use. So those are the kinds of things that we wanted to flag for you. The other thing that I want to put on the record today is that on page 86, which is section 111 of the Dash 1 amendments, that section is titled nurseries. We've had a conversation with Chair Leininger. While we understand why you would use that word, we would prefer that it would be called something else, unless we're actually talking about turning this into a nursery license. And in that case, we're going to need to do a lot of homework and get caught up to speed, because we really didn't know we would be talking about that in this context. And I just want to draw to your attention ORS 571.015, where it says the legislature finds that the propagation and raising of nursery stock is an agricultural pursuit that should be regulated and assisted by the State Department of Agriculture. And in that context, our licensing fees tend to pay for Department of Ag services that we receive, including pest and disease control, that are very vital to our industry. And so if we start talking about nursery stock in the context of cannabis here today or in the future, then we would want to start talking about that in the context of the Department of Ag as well, because that's where we go when we think about nursery stock. So just to put that on the record and let you guys know that we are paying attention and thinking about that, and happy to be a resource when it comes to our growing community. So
anybody have any thoughts on that? Okay, great.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Przanski.
Just because the nurseries are here, I know there are people who have expertise in seed production, such as Territorial Seeds. They've reached out to me, as well as those others that have the expertise in trying to do this. So I know when we get to the point of some type of a work group, they'll have some people on the ground that have actually been here in Oregon producing seeds for profit for distribution internationally.
Right. I think that makes a lot of sense. And we actually had a nice small group conversation a little bit earlier this evening, where we started to walk through some renaming and other issues that we could do for the propagation license or certification to try to meet your immediate concerns. But I think you're right. We need to weave in those other thoughts, too. Thank you. Mr. Crawford.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, my name is Seth Crawford. I teach at Oregon State University and am a marijuana policy researcher. My focus is on marijuana market structures. My research has been focused on Oregon for the last 3 years, and I just wanted to offer a few insights that maybe you could take to bat against this particular piece of legislation. First, I wanted to commend all of you for being able to put together two very workable bills, despite what's happened in the committee. Creating parallel paths between the medical market and this newly formed recreational market. I think it's really important for us to all recognize that we are not just creating a new formal market that's coming out of nowhere. We are actually moving a very robust, very long-standing existing informal market into this newly formalized marketplace. And one of the things that I think that we need to take into consideration to make this a successful transition is that existing underlying structure. One of the things that people have asked questions about at this committee is how much marijuana is being produced in the state of Oregon, how much is being consumed, what's the demand. These are basic research questions that I believe need to be addressed. Some of my work has addressed that, and the research has demonstrated that Oregon already produces enough marijuana. We have enough to meet the internal demand, and we can do that fairly easily. The more interesting aspect of that to me is who the producers are at this point and where they're located. In the state of Oregon, most producers on a per capita basis are growing marijuana in places that are, one, ecological niches for this particular agricultural crop, but two, they're also doing it in communities that have been very economically disenfranchised over the last 30 to 40 years, in particular Southern Oregon, Josephine Jackson counties, Douglas County as well. I think it's really important to be able to take that into consideration as we weigh some of the factors that we'll be going into, I think, the most important component of this legislation, which is the plant count limits, the canopy size, and the tax rates. Again, I'd like to offer my support from an academic side. Having a flat tax rate on marijuana products at the point of sale just makes sense for a number of reasons, but it also simplifies in a very meaningful way the discrepancies that we often see with marijuana products. We don't need to worry about THC percentages or anything like that. We'll have a flat tax. I think that's a great approach. I would implore you, however, to hold maybe even an additional session to discuss some of the implications of having particular plant counts and canopy sizes. Some of the earlier projections that I'd seen bandied about, we're talking about 10,000 square feet as the internal, as a inside, an indoor canopy size cap. And tell you with a very, very high level of certainty that if you were an indoor grower in Southern Oregon, the way that we can talk about land use law, greenhouses can be either indoor environments or outdoor environments, depending on the foundations and the way that they're constructed. If you're in Southern Oregon, 10,000 square feet, six cycles in one particular year would be enough to meet the entire demand of the newly created recreational market. It's about 30,000 pounds. So it's incredibly important for us to be able to tackle, I think, these issues and to do so with enough time. The last thing I would like to say is that if you were to start from scratch and be able to design some sort of economic sector in a way that would provide democratic access for producers, for consumers, for people who are involved in it, and make it the most egalitarian system that you could possibly have, you would do what we have right now in the existing marijuana market in the state of Oregon. Because it was illegal, it forced producers to remain very small, and there were a lot of benefits that were accrued by a lot of people. And we have over 45,000 grow sites registered in the state. Any type of restriction on those sizes or making it harder for people to get a license is, I think, going to end up resulting in economic inequality, increased economic inequality, and in particular, it's going to hit Southern Oregon economies and communities at a much disproportionate rate compared to other counties across the state.
Thank you, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Crawford. I would welcome any recommendations you might have in terms of if we do have a canopy size or a plant count included in the bill. I'd welcome your recommendations on what those would be. If you have time to delve further, not now because committee time is rare, but in terms of the economic impact on people who desire to be part of this industry, of how we might design the license procedures to make sure that we're not putting barriers in the way of people who are currently low income. I'd appreciate your help on that.
Great. I think Senator Cruz had a hand in. Senator Friel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be more than happy to work with Representative Helm, although working with somebody so young is going to be tough. but I think I actually think that Mr. Crawford might be helpful to us, this whole panel probably, as we get in, because land use does get into size, too. So, yeah.
Good point. All right. Senator Friel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Crawford, I think we've had this conversation before, but can you provide just a range of an estimate of what the total production currently of Oregon grows is?
Yeah, I would hesitate to say that we could get anywhere near a very specific number, but the estimates that I've provided, the state consumes about 150,000 pounds, and we produce roughly 3 to 5 times that amount.
3 to 5 times 150,000 pounds. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right, anyone else? Thank you so much, panel, for your input. And we will now welcome to the front Rob Bovet, Bo Whitney, and Patrick Moan. On deck will be Braxton Creel, Janice Patton, and Kathleen Zinno.
Chair Leininger, I'm members of the committee for the record, Rob Obett, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties. I'll be very brief and cover just four topics real quickly. I provided you a four-page written document. Actually, the first three pages cover what I'm going to talk about here briefly, and then the fourth page is actually a draft amendment that I've provided if you happen to like what I have to say here today. I thought I'd start where you just ended off, which is my number three point, land use. So what I did after you published the Dash 1 amendments is I circulated it among the County Councils Association as well as the County Planners Association. Got a lot of feedback, distilled it out, and so we have recommendations for you. With regard to land use, Section 35, we think we understand what subsection 2 is intending to do. We think that's laudable, but the way it's written, it doesn't really work as a practical matter with the statutes and the rules and the case law. So we've proposed some recrafted language you'll find under Part 3 of my memo to you with a new proposed language that we think accomplishes precisely what you're intending to do, and we will encourage you to look at that language. Subsections 3 and 4, we've heard the conversation previously about the home occupations. We share the same concerns about subsection 3 as well. We think they're unnecessary and duplicative and confusing, so we think you can simply strike subsections 3 and 4. We already have authority to do what you're intending to give us authority to do. Other than that, Section 35 looks fine. Number 2 in my memo, local time, place, and manner regulations, we noticed that time, place, and manner authority is given with respect to retail shops, but only place authority is given with respect to the other licensees. We have a concern that a licensed producer, processor, or wholesaler could create a significant public nuisance in a community, and we would be functionally precluded, preempted from doing anything about it. And essentially that would create a special class of licensed businesses that are exempt from the normal operation of nuisance laws in the state of Oregon. That doesn't make any sense to us. So we've crafted up a proposed additional paragraph C that would include the manor authority in relation to those other licensees, and that's under Part 2 of my memo. Backing up to Part 1 of my memo, this is the same old song and dance, so I'll keep it brief. This is about preemption. I lay out the reasons again why I think you ought to avoid preempting a local opt-out of any one or more class of marijuana businesses based on the federal question, and I lay out succinctly why I think you ought to avoid that, but I won't re-argue all of those. What we would ask you to do is simply restore the language in Measure 91 and not do what is purported to be done in Sections 33 and 58 and essentially allow this to flow just like it flowed and has flowed under the Oregon Liquor Control Act, which was the design of Measure 91. I find myself oddly in agreement with Mr. Helgeson, who has also filed a written testimony with you. He points out correctly the intent was to mirror existing liquor statutes, and he, you know, says flat out the local option should also be left as is, which is basically the language we, the voters, enacted into law, and I would encourage you to do the same if you don't want to do something similar to what we worked on the medical side. Last issue I'll point out for you is the tax distribution scheme. We've previously had conversations about this, and you've heard from various folks talking about that. The Dash 1 amendments don't really propose to change that, but I'd ask you to have a hard look at whether or not the two-tiered formula that's in that provision really directs the funds to where they need to go. And I can give you the example that you've heard before, which is, let's just say Weed Mart decides to locate in Eugene, and nobody wants to compete with that. But Weed Mart doesn't choose to locate in Corvallis, so you got 15 shops in Corvallis selling, let's just say hypothetically they're selling the same volume. Well, under the tax distribution formula, Corvallis would get 15 times that of Eugene when they have essentially the same needs. And so we need to find a better mechanism to distribute the tax revenues. And I have, in my testimony dated April 20th, I took a shot at it. I'm not saying it's perfect, but I have a link in my testimony today to what I crafted up back on April 20th that I think provides a more rational basis for distributing the tax revenues. So with that, I know I probably used my 2 or 3 minutes, and I'll be quiet and see if you have questions or if you want to move to other panel members.
Anybody have questions for Mr. Bobet? Okay, thank you. Sir, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, honorable members of the committee, my name is Bo Whitney. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Greenpoint, Oregon. I'm also an economist, economics university professor, and I've previously submitted public testimony to the Secretary of State's office regarding the tax revenue forecast for Measure 91. Greenpoint, Oregon, is an Oregon-based vertically integrated medical cannabis company that serves the medical community and provides patients with high-quality, high-value user experiences. We are in roughly 200 of the 230 dispensaries, and we're one of the first companies to really scale in this market. The reason I'm here today, and I've provided some written testimony as well for your review, so I'll just briefly touch on three topics. The sales tax, recreational sales in medical dispensaries, and minimal restrictions from investment outside of Oregon. The current structure, as provided in Measure 91, essentially is a weight-based tax. And this, what this does is it creates a price floor, and so that prices cannot go below a certain level. The impact of this is that it creates a delta between the market price and the recreational price. This creates certain externalities in the market and essentially drives people away from open market and into the black market. I'm proposing a tax structure whereby we do a point of sales tax between 12.5 and 17.5%. And what this does is it reduces the delta in price between the black market and open market and really drives conversion into the open market. This is based upon empirical analysis that I've done. We have a dispensary where I've done some price studies, found that this product is extremely elastic, which means that the market is very sensitive to price changes. So by reducing the price via reducing the sales tax, then you'll drive more conversion to the open market. Okay. Some of the studies out of Colorado and Washington, they have an effective tax rate between, say, 44 and 22%. Based upon an $1,800 a pound flower sale, the current structure is a 31.1% tax in Oregon. Okay. So by reducing this down, it'll drive more conversion to the open market.
Thank you. You know, I'm going to ask that you transition to the next two topics.
Sure.
If you could wrap up in the next couple of minutes, that would be great.
Yep. So Greenpoint, Oregon supports recreational sales. It'll in the medical dispensaries. This will generate immediate tax revenues for the state, but it will also help facilitate or reduce the amount of black market activity. There's currently software in place, and I'm more than happy to bring in a software company to demonstrate the functionality on a seed-to-sale system, but we can immediately differentiate between medical patients and recreational users in a medical dispensary. So the technology is there. The third point is that Greenpoint supports an environment that allows for outside investment outside of Oregon. Currently, I don't believe that there's enough money in the current Oregon market to invest in businesses here to help them support and scale. And thereby, if we restrict the amount of investment to only Oregon, then it's going to actually hurt the ability of the market to scale. So I really appreciate your time.
Thank you
for consideration.
Great. Any questions for this witness? All right, Mr. Mullen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. My name is Patrick Mullen. I'm a licensed attorney and a former law enforcement official. I spent 15 years in law enforcement, 10 years with the DEA, the last 2 years of which I served as the supervisor of the Portland Interagency Drug Task Force. I'm very familiar with the Oregon market. Currently, I am managing director of Privateer Holdings, which is a Seattle-based private equity firm that invests exclusively in the cannabis industry. I am here today to discuss Oregon not because Privateer is necessarily interested in entering the Oregon market, but more because we feel this is an opportunity for Oregon to get the regulations right and to serve as a model for the rest of the country as we move toward the end of Prohibition. Our company is focused on ending Prohibition through the development and support of responsible professional businesses in this industry. I've submitted written testimony to the committee, so I just want to quickly highlight two major points. First is, as has been mentioned before, and I'm sure you're aware, there is a robust black market operating in Oregon currently. That black market is a serious threat to the success of Measure 91 and the recreational market. The existence of that black market is directly attributable to the lack of regulation on the medical side. We have estimated, and we've provided a white paper, I believe, to the committee, that the current medical grow system in Oregon is producing enough cannabis to supply all of the medical patients in Oregon, Washington, Arizona, and Colorado combined. That excess is currently being diverted to the black market, and that black market threatens, as I mentioned, to undermine the implementation of recreational marijuana. The solution, we believe, is seed-to-sale tracking of medical and recreational, that essentially that there is parity between the two systems. The other point that I want to raise relates to residency requirements and or out-of-state investment. Besides the, somewhat obvious constitutional protectionism issue that we think it raises, we think policies requiring residency or restricting out-of-state investment will disadvantage the state of Oregon and Oregon entrepreneurs for a couple of reasons. Obviously, there is a limited pool of capital available in Oregon. It's going to hamper Oregon entrepreneurs' ability to access that capital, to scale, to innovate. It's also will allow that limited Oregon-based investor group to dictate the terms of that capital to entrepreneurs, and also limits exit opportunities for Oregon entrepreneurs. Out of state. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. That's great. Any questions, Representative Buck?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Just out of curiosity, it's I'm trying to figure out the logic. If there already is more marijuana grown in the state of Oregon, then basically it's necessary for the recreational and the medical fields. What is the logic behind saying we need to open up the state to more people to join in the industry? I'm not quite following the logic.
Sure. Well, the existing grow operations, many of them are not designed and built in a way that allows them to either scale properly or maintain, more importantly, to meet quality assurance standards. Mm. There's no lab testing currently. Our experience overseas has indicated that it's quite expensive to build a facility that can meet international quality assurance standards, meaning free from contaminants. And so these growers are going to need access to capital in order to meet those standards. And experience has shown that quite a few of the existing growers, their facilities just aren't adequate.
That deserves a longer conversation, but okay. I'll let go over there.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
All right. So now we have Braxton Creel, Kathleen Zinno, and Andrew Nonemacher. Thank you. And then on deck we have Chris McAllister, Jennifer Valley, and Aaron Purchase. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Well, we're transitioning. If I could just, Mr. Bovet's job is to continue to remind us of AOC's legal theory about preemption. And I think it's my duty to continue to remind the committee that I disagree with that. And I think we're going to get an LC opinion on this soon that helps us get to the bottom of that issue. And I hope that we will keep our minds open and wait for that opinion before we start work on making one determination or another on the preemption issue and how it affects the language of 3400.
Thank you. Okay. Panel, welcome. So we've got four of you, and I'm pleased that you're there, and I'm glad you found an additional chair. Please choose whom among you should go first, state your name for the record, and let us know what you'd like us to be thinking about.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members of the Joint Committee. My name is Braxton Creel. I am an OMMP patient, grower, and the executive director of the Canalogics Foundation, as well as a director for the Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation. I live in Clackamas, Oregon, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. The purpose of my testimony today is to bring to light some of the more concerning issues regarding House Bill 3400-1 amendment and the way that certain provisions of this bill will be a direct violation of the will of the voters and possibly the Constitution in regards to warrantless searches. First and foremost is the potential for abuse of power by the government. OLCC specifically, on page 13, section 8 specifically, states that section 29 gives the OLCC specific authority to decide who gets a license or not. I feel as though there should be specific guiding standards for this set by legislature that prevents the OLCC from abusing this privilege. They say if you use cannabis in excess, you can be denied a license. I'm here to tell you that what one person considers excess, another considers not enough. They will still be very competent and productive regardless of the amount of cannabis they consume, since we all suffer the burden of an increasing tolerance. As everyone who reads the newspaper knows, the OLCC isn't necessarily the most transparent commission, and I agree with most of the people that I know that have noticed that all three of the people present with Rob Patridge at the Russell Street Barbecue impromptu meeting made it onto the rack, but many of the actual advocates that have the people's best interest in mind were overlooked. Something there is not kosher, and if we allow a commission of prohibitionist and anti-cannabis politicians to manage our program, we will be sabotaging our success from the start. Second is the warrantless searches that are proposed for people with and without notice in regards to premises. I am no lawyer, but I know that this does seem to infringe on the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. I ask that legislature consider removing this from the bill altogether in the name of preserving the Constitution our nation was founded upon. I would like to thank all of you for all of your hard work that you are doing to implement Measure 91 and ask that each of you read the original Measure 91 as it was approved by the voters, and please implement the will of the people as it was written. Please take into consideration if we leave the rulemaking and law enforcement to the very people who oppose our industry and have openly alleged that the OMMP growers are criminals, then how can we expect to convert the industry players over when the OLCC gets to determine who gets a license and who doesn't? By allowing OLCC such a long leash, we will be moving further away from the intended goal of legalization of marijuana. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions for this witness? Okay, please go ahead.
Hi, my name is Kathleen Zeno. My name is Kathleen Zeno, and I'm an OMMP patient. I had a couple concerns. Let me get my thoughts together. I guess I wanted to, I'll introduce myself. I've had 5 brain surgeries. I have a rare brain condition that requires, there's only 3 options when you get diagnosed with it. There's 2 medications and shunts, and that's pretty much it. The shunts aren't very, they don't work very well. But I did find out later that actually cannabis oil does significantly help. Unfortunately, it requires a large amount. I'm just concerned. Let me get my thoughts together. I apologize. I feel like this is all really complicated. It's affecting the people that are like Janice and I. We both have the same brain condition. She found the oil before I did. She was able to avoid brain surgery, and I unfortunately have not. I still have more. And I'm just concerned that this whole process is extremely complicated, and it affects people like us the most with plant limits and the warrantless searches and the seed-to-cell tracking. And it turns into just a really, really big mess. And at the end of the day, you know, our options are stay in the hospital and go on the pharmaceuticals, which end up killing us a lot quicker, or trying to work with you guys, and we have to stay healthy enough to even get to this point. I mean, today alone, it took 4 people just to get here to help me and help her, you know, because we're disabled. We're fighting for our lives at the same token, and we want the opportunity to sit down and go over that. You know, we are the ones that will be affected and cut first. A lot of growers have cut us out because we take so much. We take all of our garden. I alone take over, what was the amount we were on? 36 plants. 36 plants a month, right? It was a month? What we were up to? No, a what?
It's a harvest.
A harvest. 36 plants a harvest. So already if you cut it down to 12 or 6, I'm screwed. And it's kind of like, how many days a week can I be well? Like, I haven't been able to access my oil lately. I've been homebound. I've been limited on what I can do. My doctors are limited on what I can do because there's a treatment that works. We've got a lot of restrictive laws in place that are making everything pretty convoluted and difficult to decipher. And I would love to have an opportunity to have some patients just actually like sit down in a non-stressful environment with you know the people that are affected the most. And I would ask of you guys if you'd be willing to let us do that, to get some of these people that will be affected first, you know, with the way that the laws are changing. Is that something that we could set up? I mean, there's a lot of concerns and a lot of notes and things are pretty complicated, and 3 minutes isn't enough to go over that. And
yeah, that's a great suggestion. I would be really happy to have a conversation later.
That would be great. Yeah. Thank you.
Any follow-up? Representative Buckley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just to be sure, thank you for your testimony. Please know that in both pieces of legislation, there's no desire to create a situation with warrantless searches. In trying to regulate this new industry, we're looking at the liquor store model in terms of the OLCC regulations, and they wouldn't be doing a warrantless search of a liquor store that they regulate. But it's their job to make sure that liquor store is operating within regulations, and that's what's envisioned in regard to the recreational marijuana outlets as well. So I hope this, I want to try to assure you there's no desire from this committee to try to create a system, a gotcha system. That's not the intent.
May I comment back?
Sure.
Well, my concern was that the way it's written is that basically if there's reasonable suspicion, which is not defined, what is reasonable suspicion consider? It's saying anyone in a legal authority that's under either police or government or institution, the very first page it's talking about that, or page, where are we at, page 10, it talks about how that, like, anyone with an official title can, under reasonable suspicion, do an investigation. If OHA wants to investigate, the OLCC laws apply to that investigation. So then a patient becomes, if I'm understanding it correctly, the way it's written was that the patient then goes under those laws.
You know what, I'm gonna let Senator Prezonsky make his comment or respond. Perhaps as part of your comment, you could respond.
Yeah, thank you. Kathleen, a couple of things. The term of art, reasonable suspicion, is pretty well defined by law as to how that works within a search warrant, et cetera. I mean, that's criminal law. So there's a whole body of law that's been interpreting what it requires to go in front of a judge to get that authority to do that. So this is not something new. It's not something different. I did want to say, based on your comments, I understand a lot of them are not really focused on the bill that we're dealing with today, but possibly the one that came out of the Senate side on the 964. I hope that maybe we as a joint committee may actually revisit that issue in a different piece of legislation that looks at the medical as a unit, as a group, as compared to seeing what's come from the Senate when it goes over to the House. But because the
it
area
crosses
of the,
over quite a bit, and
oh,
that's the concern, is it the gray area?
Right. But when we get into the area of 3400 and we're talking about licensing, a lot of the issues about limiting to the size of the number of plants and stuff are going to be completely in a different setting than what they would be in the medical.
So thank you. I'm going to transition to our next speaker, but please feel free to call my office, and I'd be happy to set a meeting and have a conversation with a group of medical
that patients. Would be very helpful.
One quick comment?
Yes, please.
Thank you. And I really appreciate you bringing forward. I think there needs to be some thought put into a category of medical need, of significant medical need.
The state satisfies it as a, they call it categorically needy clients.
Right.
And it basically just means, like, that's what I'm stated as. And that basically just means that I'm eligible for complete services at any point in time. I can enter into a nursing home. That's where I'm at. Hospice, palliative care. Okay. So that's kind of what I would, the ultimate protection of that, because I'll be at that state for, well, until I pass. So
can you repeat what that phrase is?
It's palliative care. It's,
okay.
Or hospice. Is it categorically needy?
Categorically needy.
Categorically needy. Okay. And that's referring to just the medical status of somebody that requires extensive help, caregivers, nursing care, medical, all the things.
So, thank you so much.
Thank you. So our next speaker is Janice Patton. Welcome.
Yes. Hi, everybody. I appreciate your time today. I'm a medical patient, and I'm here with the more human side of the story. Like Katie said, I have a rare brain disorder. It's called intracranial hypertension. I was treated by my doctor 2.5 years ago with a medication that causes giant kidney stones, so it shut my kidneys down. They told me I would have to have a shunt put in my brain, but I had less than a 20% chance of survival. She went ahead and did the shunt. I went on the internet and looked for alternative resources, and I found cannabis oil. It's been working. My doctors are amazed. I mean, it's the only thing known to man right now that keeps down spinal pressure. Downfall with it is it takes 3 grams a day, and that's roughly $3,000 a month worth of oil. I grow as much as I'm allowed by law. It takes all of that plus 2 other people's full amount of their cards for me to stay alive every day. I know that there's got to be some regulation, but I'm just letting you know today, if there is a chance of going in and cutting the amount of plants that people can grow, even the big farms, because right now there is a big farm out there that is donating oil to me to help me, because I am on disability. I can't afford $3,000 a month for oil. If you start cutting those plants, I'm going to tell you this, if it comes to play, keep me in mind, you start cutting those plant numbers, I die. She's gone. And we're not the only two people in Oregon that are surviving alone on this oil. We need it. And it takes a lot. Way more than I could grow. Way more than, you know, it's more than what these people can, most of the people here can do. We need these plant counts. If anything, I today would like to propose an increase in the amount of plants that people can grow in Oregon legally. Thank you for your time. I appreciate
it. Great. Andrew Nonnemacher, welcome.
Hi there. My name's Andrew Nonnemacher. I'm the executive director of Compassion Center. We're a medical marijuana clinic, nonprofit, and an education center. Thank you, Chair Leininger, and the rest of the committee. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So Compassion Center and I basically pretty much oppose this bill in its entirety. The plant limits are especially concerning, and I would just like to say, first of all, I have 3 points to make. The first one is that there is less than 6 weeks in session. Maybe it's longer, I don't know, but very small time in session. I know at another committee meeting there was an analogy that you guys might be monkeys with guns in the fact that you're experimenting with the laws at this point in time. So I guess I don't see why you don't focus on the recreational, experiment with that. And then after that's figured out, find out what works and what doesn't, and then start regulating the medical program.
Thank you. I really appreciate you. Did you finish your remark?
No, but did you have something to say?
Well, I wanted to note that we are now talking about a recreational bill only.
Okay.
But I think those points, I appreciate you making those points, and that's a valid perspective.
Sure. Then if that's the case, I really don't have much to say.
Well, we really appreciate your being here, and any follow-up questions for these folks? Thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us.
Give me a hand.
So now we have Chris McAllister, Jennifer Valley, and Aaron Purchase. And then on deck we have PK and John Anderson and Kimberly McCulloch. Welcome. Whomever would like to go first, let us know your name, confirm your name for the record, and we'll look forward to hearing your comments.
Hello, Representative Leininger. Thank you for having me here today. As you guys know, my name is Erin Purchase. Thank you guys for all of your hard work. I have just a few concerns on HB 3400. I mostly support this. I think it's great. It's put together very nicely. One of my main concerns reading through this was with the giving local governments the authority to completely ban retail outlets. I have had some unique personal interactions with this. I worked with several of the counties as they implemented bans. And as a patient, I was testifying and working towards allowing safe access. I feel like it's very important. As a patient, as a mother of a child using cannabis, and as a parent in our community, I like recreational and medical marijuana dispensaries because your ID is checked at the door. The products on the shelves are tested. You have an office person and a what they call a bud tender to help you with your selection. I'm not forced to go into somebody's bedroom where they could have pot and heroin and cocaine and God knows what, along with whatever else. I like to go into retail outlets and purchase medicine legally. And some of the people that are put into authority to regulate our cities and counties don't feel the same about medical marijuana or marijuana in general. I would love it if they could spend a day in my shoes, but they can't. And instead, they are here to form our laws and our regulations, which is great, and I applaud them for their efforts. But a lot of the time they look at marijuana and they think criminals, and they want to ban it from their community. Yet they're fueling the black market, and they're banning patients from safe access. I live in Oregon City. Oregon City doesn't want retail outlets at all. And the members of our community have to drive clear into Portland. And a lot of the disabled community cannot drive. And it takes a long time to get on a bus. And instead, they'll go to their neighbor's house who grows pot. You guys, as a committee, are here to make sure that our recreational market thrives. And by banning it out of communities, I can tell you that going to the neighbor's house is much easier than driving to another city to get it. I don't think that we should have to walk around as patients and collect signatures saying that we voted this law into effect and now you want to ban us.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're going to try to focus only on the recreational bill.
Oh, recreational. Exactly. Yeah. I look at it as the same. A lot of medical patients don't want to pay for their card anymore. So they're going to be using recreational stores.
Okay.
I don't think that we should have to walk around and collect signatures based off of something we voted into effect. Another thing is just with,
I saw some written testimony saying that
most patients don't use 7.5 grams of cannabis a day, and that's crazy. My 7-year-old uses 3 pounds a month in her cannabis oil. You have to take in the concentrated cannabis oil, which most people are using nowadays. Okay. It takes a lot of cannabis to make that oil. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Welcome.
Hi. My name is Jennifer Valley. I'm from Happy Valley. For the most part, I agree with everything in this bill. I was a little concerned with licensure requirement for seed production. I think farmers should always have the right to produce their own seeds without necessarily having a license. It's something we've had to fight with Monsanto over with on other crops, and I don't want to see this crop Monsantoized. The other issue is I was on the advisory committee working on Clackamas County's time, manner, and place legislation for medical, and I saw how incredibly unreasonable they were. By the time we were done, well, they started out with 10% of the county that they would allow dispensaries in at all, and then they zoned it out until there were approximately 20 different properties available where a dispensary could be. But when we went and visited all of those properties, we found that none of them would contact us back, and at least half of them were swampland that can't be developed. So they weren't really operating in good faith, and that's with medicine that people need to stay alive. It's my concern that when it's time for recreational regulations to be put in place, that they will have a much lesser degree of respect. And this is an industry that our state needs. You know, we need to be able to have tourists come to Oregon and visit Pendleton and visit the gorge and visit the mountain and visit the beach and not have to worry that they've stumbled into a Wild West show straight out of California where the rules change every time they step over a city line.
Right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to note in response to the seeds issue that I believe it's the intent of the bill, and I think it's the intent of the committee, that the propagation license that would enable one to sell seeds and starts would mean that someone holding that license could sell seeds and starts to the recreational and the medical side, but that farmers who are producing their own product would have the right to use their own seeds to regenerate or produce future crops, if I'm using the wrong words.
Yeah.
So it's one legal way of getting them, but it's not the only legal way of getting them. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Madam Chair, esteemed members of the committee, citizens of Oregon, I appreciate the conversations I've had with many of you, your staffs, and some of your answering machines. My last became.
I'm sorry, sir.
Chris McAllister.
You so much.
I last came before this body in favor of House Bill 3400 in a modified form. I'm here today to remove that support. Measure 91 deserves to move forward on its merits and the voters' will. One of those repeated tenets was 91 does not affect OMMP. If the latter portions of this bill, such as sections 98, 99, 100 on page 79, page 80, section 101 and 102 pass, which I do not support, I ask that the OHA be held to the same level of fees, fines, and disallowances for missed deadlines, incomplete processes, and passing on incorrect, improperly vetted, or incomplete information. As it stands, it's currently very difficult to collect data regarding the OMMP, OMMDP program participants, as the programs do not currently collect data on PRF, grove site owners, or caregivers' ages to be able to gauge the financial and economical effects that current and protected future additions are codified in this amendment. So by those statements, I mean we currently cannot get information about whether or not they move the concentrate makers to 21 and over. And so we feel that there's ways for OHA and the OLCC to change and alter. And so there are some preemptive items that could be taken down the road at another point. And it's not what the 3400 originally spoke to, and it's not what Measure 91 seems to speak to. So I have very strong concerns. And when I spoke to staffers, they said that this bill does not touch OHA at all, and I found 25 references that it does. So,
okay. Thank you. Thanks for your comments. We'll take a look at anybody have any immediate questions. It's good food for thought for us. Thank you all very much. All right. So our next
Happy
panel.
Happy birthday, Representative Helm.
Thank you.
So our next panel is PK. John Anderson and Kimberly McCullough, and on deck we have Scott Winkles, Lisa Nato, and Jonathan Manton.
Thank you, councilors. It's a pleasure to talk with you. My name's Peter E. Kramer, Mercy TV. Film this for the television to show the people what's happening in the government. Thanks for Dr. LeBeck. I knew him somewhat personally. He passed away a week or two ago. And he was one of the people that wanted cannabis to be legal. And he helped with the medical side. With 3,400, I disagree with it. The people voted it in 91 with the understanding that they wouldn't mess with the OMMP. And we're not going to talk about that. But thank you. And we'll talk to you real soon.
Thank you so much for being here and sharing your thoughts.
Would you like to go? Would
you
like
me? You can go.
Okay. My name is John Anderson, Salem, and I'm actually rather embarrassed because I haven't read House Bill 3400. I've read the Senate bill, which I'm mostly against. As a medical patient, it was my understanding that Measure 91 completely excluded OMMP, and I don't understand why it has made its way into the House bill. But I am a medical patient, and I can say that the I consider marijuana, I used to consider it a drug until I tried it for my medical conditions, and it cured my Lyme disease in 5.5 weeks. So I can walk up and down stairs again. But I'm usually very politically active, and I just simply don't have anything to really add at this time because I haven't read the bill.
Well, thank you for coming here and sharing your thoughts. And I will say that I'm confident we'll have more than one public hearing on the bill. So, you know, feel free to take a little time and digest it. And
You'll
we'll
see
welcome
me again.
You back. Yeah, thank you.
All right.
Chair Leininger and members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I have a few specific comments about House Bill 3400. First, in regards to the residency requirement that's in here that requires someone to live in the state of Oregon for 2 or more years before becoming a licensee, we have concerns that this is likely a violation of the Dormant Commerce Clause. I haven't provided any citations in my testimony. I'm assuming that this is an issue that LC is advising you on, but if you would like any additional legal analysis, I offer up my services, so just let me know. As to the age verification scanners, I'm very happy to see the changes in the bill that indicate that the commission can't use the information that's obtained by those scanners for any purpose other than age verification, and that it can't be retained. I would just suggest one small tweak, which would be to add a clarification that those provisions also apply to the retailer and their ability to retain or use that information for something else. So it's just a very small change. As to the civil penalties, I know Mr. Mayor, when he was here on Monday, mentioned that was something that was going to change. I just wanted to make a comment about that, to say we appreciate that change is being made and that's going to mirror alcohol. As far as the criminal penalties, there's a number of sections at the end. It's 122 through 124 that are going to provide for reductions of sentences. Again, just wanted to comment that we're very pleased to see that and to encourage the committee to take those penalties down as low as possible. You know, the will of the voters of the state of Oregon is really to end the war on marijuana and to address this issue with a different approach, being education, drug treatment, and essentially harm reduction models for dealing with drug addiction and abuse. And so when thinking about these sort of criminal penalties and the impact that they have on people's lives, we would suggest moving things down to violations in particular. When it has to do with young people and the mistakes that people make when they're young, and not having that have this long-term impact on their life and their ability to become a productive citizen. Along those lines, earlier in the session, Representatives Frederick Leininger and Witt also sponsored a bill, House Bill 3372, which would have provided for reductions of sentences of people who are currently serving time for marijuana possession and transfer and delivery. It would have also made it easier to get an exoneration if you've already served your sentence. We would very much support an amendment to House Bill 3400 along those lines. Whether or not you're willing to go as far as that other bill went, you know, I know it's open to debate, but whatever you do, we really think it's unfair to legalize marijuana recreationally for the people of Oregon and have
a whole bunch of people still suffering the consequences of this old policy that we've decided to have be a thing of the past. And finally, I just want to make one comment just so that you know what our position is on the opt-out provisions. We're pleased to see that this version of the bill does not change the opt-out provisions that are in Measure 91. We believe that that was passed because of the will of the voters. It's what the voters wanted. And we encourage you not to change those provisions and to honor the voters of Oregon. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Representative
Madam Chair, it's a rare occasion that I would agree with someone representing ACLU, but
thank you.
Disregard.
But did you?
I'm done.
Okay, thank you. So
I'm
much.
Stressed out now.
Yes,
I want to say the black market was here a long time now, since the federal government made cannabis marijuana illegal. We lost a lot of good products that the hemp and the cannabis plant can be used for.
Yes.
The other thing is taxes.
Okay. We've you know what, sir? I'm sorry to cut you off, but we've got a long list of folks still, and we've already had your turn. But next time, I hope you'll finish those thoughts or submit them in writing.
Well, the taxes should be at the moment of purchase.
Okay, and in fact, you know what? That is reflected in this draft, so thank you for raising that. Okay, thanks, everyone. We've got our next panel, which is... So we've got Scott Winkles, Lisa Nato, and Jonathan Manton, and on deck we have Shane Yoakum, Nikki Terzieff, and Anthony Johnson. Thank you.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. I'm going to, we've done some analysis of the dash ones of 3400. I would not say that analysis is complete yet and is involving a number of people, but we do, and so I would not take my comments as exclusive. I do want to comment specifically on Section 33 and the preemption on the local opt-out. I agree with Mr. Bovet in that we should revert back to the liquor control, to the statute that was passed in 91 that reverted back to the liquor control statute. That was with our understanding, as the committee is aware, the League and the AOC have submitted a legal memo. It outlines that would not be an exclusive remedy or an exclusive method of opting out, that there would be other methods available. We strongly believe in that opinion, in that assessment. Additionally, we would also ask that to encourage the committee to take a look at removing the preemptions on local taxation as well. We believe that there will be more dispensaries in the state. More cities will be comfortable in allowing a retail establishment to go forward if they have the ability to impose a local taxation to ensure that there's that they're compensated for additional cost and for moving forward. I did want to address Representative Helms' point as to the Legislative Council opinion. I would point out Legislative Council has actually opined on this subject March 3rd of 2014. Senator Ferraioli had asked the Legislative Council to analyze the Emerald Steel decision. I will provide that committee, that LC opinion, I'm in possession of it, to Mr. Crawford, and we will put it on the record. But essentially, it holds that there is this conflict between the CSA, the Controlled Substances Act, and what the state has what the state is able to do. It does exist. And I'd point out that in Medford, recently, the city of Medford won an injunction based on that federal preemption question against a medical dispensary. We believe that decision would hold. Again, there are cities in Oregon where this is going to work, and there are cities that will allow this to go forward as stands, but there are cities where they're very uncomfortable moving forward, and there are cities that might be willing to move forward.
but want to take their time and want to have some robust conversations with their citizens. Again, I would point to the experience that Kirkland, Washington went through. Kirkland, Washington passed Washington's legalization amendment by a wide margin. To this day, there are still no retail establishments in Kirkland, to my knowledge. They're still getting pushback from the citizens, the neighbors, the businesses in that community who aren't comfortable with retail recreational marijuana going in. I don't know why we wouldn't expect to see that happen here. And that's the impact of that is not going to be felt at the state level. That's going to be felt at the local level. It's at the city council and the county commission level. And giving the cities the most flexibility in implementing Measure 91 legalization in terms of finances, in terms of regulation, and in terms of when it's time, when it's appropriate for the to allow, when the citizens are comfortable, is, I think, the easiest and the path of least resistance into achieving what people want, which is a functioning retail recreational system. And with that, I'm open to your questions.
Anybody have any comments on that? Mr. Helm, Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Scott, I should have asked Mr. Bavette this is the same question, but I just thought I might as well get you guys to make a statement on the record now. Are you going to ask us to abandon Section 60 of Measure 91? That's the existing opt-out that the voters approved.
Madam Chair, Representative Helm, I think the existing opt-out, as it's crafted now, mirrored after the liquor statute, is fine.
As written.
I mean, that. Keep in mind, though, that language was adopted in the Oregon Constitution well over 100 years ago, and there's significant case law and baggage behind it. Had the crafters had full understanding of that case law and the historical context in which it was adopted, I highly doubt they would have chosen it. But that's what they asked the voters to approve.
And just one follow-up.
Please, yes.
Is it your opinion that all that past interpretation of that section in the liquor control statute is going to be governing of the text now as freshly written?
Madam Chair, Representative Helm, that's the advice I've received from my counsel.
You want to make a follow-up?
But keep in mind, if I may, Oregon is a strong home rule state. Our home rule amendment is in the Constitution. Cities don't get their authority from the legislature. They obtain it from their home rule charters in the Oregon Constitution. What wasn't in that measure in 91 was language that said that preempted any other authority. That was absent. And so if you're going to take away something that's guaranteed and the voters have put in the Constitution and repeal charters that have been approved by voters, we need to be absolutely clear. And that's not what happened in Measure 91.
So, Senator Przanski has a...
Yeah, I just want to follow up. Scott, what I'm hearing you saying, I think you just said it again, is that you may not be opposed to what's in Measure 91 as it says for the opt-out, but you've now said on the record you think that there's other ways to get around that because you're taking the position that this wasn't an exclusive opt-out procedure.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, yes, that's precisely what I'm saying, and it's reflected in the written legal statement that was provided to this committee previously, which I can provide a new copy of if you'd...
Oh, no, that's fine. So then I just want to follow up, if I could, one other question, and that's basically your example. What I heard was that if cities had the right to tax locally, they may be more comfortable to allow these facilities to be located in their communities. So basically, if they pay the tax, then they might be able to get there. But Kirkland, Washington, seems to not follow that approach. So what gives you such confidence that local taxation, which is allowed in Washington, where you have a community that did not or has not cited a commercial facility, is going to somehow remarkably do that here in the state of Oregon if they have the right to have local taxation?
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, I I will confess that my memory of the Washington statute is not as up to speed as yours, but my understanding from talking to my colleagues at AW, our sister association in Washington, is that the cities were not receiving the shared revenue scheme as is in the state measure. I'd have to double check with them to make sure that's the case, but there was a in my conversations with my counterpart in Washington, I think we have a different understanding of that, of how that measure is being implemented.
It'd be nice to clarify, because I understand there's three tiers or three levels of taxation in the state of Washington. That's why it's at 40% right now on products.
Yeah.
All right. Any follow-up questions? Okay. Thank you. Ms. Nato, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Nato, representing Phylos Bioscience. And I'm here to thank you for the -1 amendments to House Bill 3400. We support the certification of the labs that you've included, the health and safety standards of testing cannabis for consumers of cannabis. We believe this will serve as a national model, so thank you for your work in that. I want to especially thank Representative Leininger, Madam Chair, for introducing the concept of a propagation certification and working together. We had an informal meeting today, and we will work through some of the issues that have arisen. I think they're workable, and we have want to improve the measure, listen to any concerns that members of the industry or others have. So thank you for that. And finally, a thank you to Representative Buckley for introducing the concept of research certification. This is needed, and it's needed quickly, as we're even want to develop the standards for consumer health and safety testing and expand those. So thank you for introducing that. We look forward to working through those issues. I think Mark Mayer testified that they needed some work, and we look forward to doing that work. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Sun-Grown Growers Guild. And I wanted to just very briefly, I know we've got a lot on your agenda, and I want to have plenty of time for other folks to speak because I get to talk to you all the time. But I want to share with you just the perspective of the small family farmer in Southern Oregon now, kind of quick status check on this, and share just a few thoughts as we're moving forward. On market conditions, kind of guessing what's happening, what's going to happen, if there's the opt-out portion in the medical program, which has been included in other bills. So regardless of how things happen with the opt-outs, if some counties across the state, cities across the state are opting out, then what you have is your medical growers now without much of a market to sell their product into. And so the OLCC piece comes in, and there's been some conversations around, well, there should be another path for them. So you'd have one path if you're selling just medicine, which is what we want to do. You sell the medicine, you've got a medical dispensary to sell into. That's great. If that path's not working out well, then you would be able to opt into like an OLCC process and follow the OLCC rules and comply with everything the OLCC wants you to do. Some of those OLCC rules, though, could be so burdensome or onerous that would not be an appealing pathway either. And if that's the case, then we're not going to get at solving the black market problem, which we all have a shared approach to doing. Mm-hmm. So specifically on that point, with just recognizing that it's a family farm operation that's happening, and so some of the rules around peace officer authority, for example, when we're talking about honor around the premises, some of these kind of technical things that might scare folks away just because of privacy concerns from operating on a family farm versus maybe what OLCC has been inspecting in the past. Like, if we're going to be funneling people into that path, we need to keep in mind that these are small family farmers, responsible community members, but they may not have electricity to install a security camera on the grow site. Like, they have electricity on their farm over here. If you're talking about bringing a peace officer walking past someone's bedroom to get to the backyard to inspect the facility, are they going to be able to just come in and do that whenever they want because they're inspecting the grow site without notifying the people first? Like, these things that just need to reflect, I think, rural, small town, living, and it's on a family farm, so that we're not running people off. We're bringing people into the regulated market, not chasing them off. The land use piece is obviously very important. We want to keep talking about that. Some of the family farms are on, EFU land. Some would be on most that I'm familiar with are on the rural residential piece, and there's some on forested land that's small woodlot farms. It's the designations that have been shared with me. I think there's conversations ongoing around a medical processor's license and what that might look like, and so we want to keep working with you on that.
And then finally, there are some great ideas, I think, about how we can bring people in. The one in particular, I think, that's been championed by Senator Farioli up to this point, as well as others, has been to allowing the medical dispensaries to be supplied by the medical growers to supply the rec market as we do this transition. And ways like that we can provide incentives to those who are already growing in the medical market, if they have the excess, they need a viable market to sell into, and recognizing that they are on small rural family farm type of situations. Just that approach, I think, is the best way to get at solving the black market, which we all want to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Scott, question, or at least an observation for you. Looking at the situation as it exists in Grants Pass and Josephine County, first of all, Josephine County is home rule charter. But looking at the city of Grants Pass, currently they are denying business licenses to dispensaries based on the federal listing. They've upped the ante here in the last week or so by looking to also deny, based on the same issue, the federal scheduling, denying people the opportunity to grow even in greenhouses within the city limits of Grants Pass. On the other hand, I see the county of Josephine beginning to see some dispensaries pop up in the county. I am not entirely sure the county is going to make any move to change that. So I guess my question would be, as you see the situation maturing across the state, do you expect to see situations kind of like what we're seeing in Josephine County?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Wilson, yes. And I think it'll happen both ways. I can think of counties that will be more restrictive. You'll have cities that will be more permissive inside, that are located with inside counties that are going to be more restrictive, and vice versa, as what you've described with Grants Pass and Josephine. Typically, it's actually an interesting question. It opens up a can of worms going in issues that have nothing to do with marijuana, whether or not the county ordinance would rule within a city. Typically, and I'm glad Mr. Bovet's not up here, because we'd have to have a knife fight or something. But cities don't recognize counties as a superior government in the state.
There might be a similar situation in the legislature.
Vice Chair Farioli, I mean, catch us on a good day and it's fine. The city home rule predates county home rule. City charters actually predate statehood in many cases. So we believe that the city's choice to would prevail. What I don't think has been contemplated, and certainly hasn't been in the amendments, is what would happen if hypothetical example, if Curry County were to do an initiative and prohibit, and Bandon wanted to go forward, would it be an action of the council to recognize the county ordinance, or would the city's citizens of Bandon have to go to their own initiative to allow? And I don't know that that's been contemplated within the measure, any of the materials I've seen.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
If to follow on that, and not to instigate the knife fight that has been threatened, would the cities welcome clarification in House Bill 3400 that a vote of a county commission would not take away the right of a city to determine its own fate in this issue?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, I might come see you for a note to craft something along those lines. I think we'd rather be cautious in how we craft it, because I think if that issue went to court, it would impact a number of other issues, ranging from sick leave to gun control. And so, let's not do that.
It has to be good. I can follow. And I do appreciate that. And I did. It was interesting to see that the cities and counties that voted on moratoriums, just in Jackson County, for instance, we had cities that decided to do the one-year moratorium on dispensaries, other cities that didn't. Jackson County, as their county commission, did vote, but they didn't try to impose their will on Ashland or on Talent or anything. There seemed to be an understanding between the cities and the counties. If we do have to clarify, I agree it'd have to be done very carefully. But I share that concern that might happen in a county where a county commission could be. And we looked at the vote on Measure 91, a county-by-county vote, and there were some votes that were very, very close in counties. And you could see a situation where a county commission might say, you know what, we're going to vote to prohibit the medical marijuana dispensaries, for instance, even though the cities in our counties would like to have them. So I think I'd love to have an additional discussion with you on that.
Certainly.
Excellent. Any other questions? All right. Thank you so much. More to come on that. And then we have four more speakers, just so folks know where we are.
That's what I say, man.
Okay. So we have Nikki Terziev, Anthony Johnson, and Shane Yoakum. And then our last two are Bradley Steinman and Lucas Littlefield. All right, whomever would like to begin, please introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. Hello, members of the committee. My name is Shane Yoakum. I'm a longtime Oregon medical marijuana patient and cannabis breeder here in the state of Oregon. I've worked for over 10 years creating new medical marijuana strains for the community. I'm also the president of the Cannabis Genetics Preservation Society. We are a new nonprofit organization dedicated to educating the community and to help construct sensible policies regarding cannabis genetics during a time of transition within our industry. I've been working on seeds in the state since the implementation of 3460, Measure 91, copied and pasted using the same language that seeds are unusable. I really just want to be short and sweet tonight. When I started discussing my philosophies and ideas about breeder programs and nursery permits with others in the scientific community about 2 months ago, my intent was not to create a strict certification system for cannabis breeders. I see that in House Board 3400 in Sections 111 through 118, it suggests that the OLCC must certify breeders who want to produce seeds. I am actually here tonight to question exactly what quantifies this certification process. As the gentleman said earlier, we are transitioning from a unregulated black market into a legal market. Humans have grown and bred cannabis throughout history with no certification for thousands of years. The people who know the most about the cannabis species have been working in the field and studying the plant for years without ever having any type of degree certifying us. There are currently no educational institutions teaching the taxonomy of cannabis, cannabis genealogy, pollen techniques, evolutionary theory, and advanced topics such as epigenetics in the state of Oregon. I encourage this certification not to be too elaborate, as this will just be forcing more people to turn to the black market. You hit on the subject earlier that the farmers aren't allowed to or are allowed to produce seeds. I think that we actually need to make sure that the farmers are allowed to make their own seeds and produce their own seeds. We need to keep the seeds in the hands of the people. When a farmer can't produce his own seed stock, that's not freedom, that's control, and that's something that we need to preserve. Oregon has a long history and legacy of cannabis genetics, and we need to preserve them.
I think that's a fair point. May I jump in just briefly? So I hope you heard that there's not an intention to prevent farmers from being able to create their own seeds.
I understand that now.
And then the other thing is we were trying to address, and I appreciate your input, we were trying to address the situation of where does one who's seeking to grow legally but who's getting started get the seeds and starts from that's legal? And so someone who's providing seeds and starts might need to have more numbers than would otherwise be
correct
permissible. So we were trying to come up with some way that's not unduly burdensome, but that provides a you're not breaking any rules pathway for the folks who are trying to fill that important niche. But your comments are good comments, and hopefully we can weave them in to make sure that the outcome is something that you feel like honors the good work you're doing and helps meet those needs also.
So, absolutely.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Great.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
I just want to follow up on that, and I guess it was Shane. What I'm hearing, I think Co-Chair Langer may have covered it, is that your concern as to not only you individually but others that are in the field that may
everybody
not meet
in the state
that criteria.
Who are working in the field as cannabis breeders, correct. Most of the people who are breeding in the state have a wealth of knowledge that you cannot go and obtain from a four-year school. And once you're out of that school, you have to work in the field for years. And that's what we've all been doing. We have a wealth of knowledge. We can write books on this subject. We could teach college courses. Yeah. But, you know, what actually quantifies this certification? So I guess what I'm really, you know, kind of proposing is that we need to have a subcommittee to with breeders and genealogists to facilitate exactly what is this certification.
If I could you provide your contact information?
Absolutely,
to
absolutely.
Adam, that way we'll make sure we have
great.
It.
Great.
Thank you.
All right, Ms. Terzieff, welcome.
Thank you. Probably just use one. Nikki Terzieff here on behalf of the Oregon Cannabis Business Council, OCBC. Just friendly reminder, we're an industry association. We really work from harvest to home and all the stops in between. And one of the statewide membership and one of the things that we really focus on, in addition to being sensitive to public welfare, public safety, public concerns and optics, if you will, around the conversation, is some of the mechanics. And a little bit late in the bill, I don't know, page 72 or so moving forward, there's a little spot that mentions a little word, edibles. And edibles is something that we are increasingly interested in promoting in conversation. And I'll just say there's a lot of model out there that we can learn from Colorado. Caps on dosage, for instance. Colorado uses a 10-milligram cap or a 100-milligram saleable package. And I'm saying this acknowledging that a lot of this can be done in rural, but I think it's imperative that we have the conversation and look at statutory framework for some of this as well, so that in Representative Helms' birthday cake, we know exactly what he's going to be getting per slice, for instance. So the need for a processor's license or...
Zero. Yeah.
Zero. The need for a processor's license, and I think if we could address or start to explore a separate edible processing license, that would be ideal. If not, something that's very robust for the endorsement process, so that if you're going to have an endorsement on your processor's license, it's not just kind of a couple of questions buried somewhere in the application. Again, acknowledging that a lot of this can be done by rule, but I want to make sure that we're putting on record our grave concerns about having this sector of the industry left behind. If you're going to lift the entire industry, if you're going to tell the whole story, the narrative has to include each stop and not have one sector orphaned, if you will. That's one subgroup. And another subgroup that we conduct meetings with across the state are dispensaries. And a couple of pieces came out of a very recent meeting we had from dispensaries all around Oregon. And some of the concerns are about chain of custody. And having a very clear piece of language somewhere in here talking about chain of custody after it's entered the market. Is that at the point for labs? Is labs where we know this is what's going to be in the market, this is what can be traced? For the ease of identification, for law enforcement, for even, I suppose, the OLCC authority, police authority, to be able to say, this is a bag of marijuana, this is a product that the state knows about, and this is not, makes those stops incredibly easier for both law enforcement and the person in question, somebody with their paperwork. Looking at what we can do to maintain product integrity, does that mean that it's a tamper-proof package that the state is now tracking so that a dispensary owner and ultimately a patient or soon to be an adult use user knows that what they've walked out the store with is what was tested at the lab, that label matches, that product inside. And certainly we're not trying to be accusatory, but one kid ruins recess for everybody, and that's a question that we would all have to answer at the end of the day. So the ability to track, the ability to trace, the integrity of the product, the health and safety of the public, I think we've got a couple of ways to go about doing this. Again, perhaps the details are in rule, but we need you to give us a clear directive, or the agency a clear directive, to really examine what that looks like all the way along the line. Some of the other pieces for the dispensaries are insurance and bonding obligations. I'll just note that exists already, and we have some resources, and I suppose we'd want to make sure that we're encouraging that conversation. That piece is just fine by us. Backup PRFs at a dispensary. This is something we've discussed. PRF, the person in charge.
We didn't get that done.
Representative Buckley. we'd love to.
Yeah.
And that's just something, a financial piece for the sake of business moving forward. Should something happen to the PRF, there is no one left legally in charge. There is no one left fiscally responsible. That's a problem. in our perspective. Other things such as bud handlers cards or bud tenders cards, similar to a beverage or a server card done through OLCC, little things that we think are going to be assurances to the public and guidelines for the businesses so that they're not walking into problematic situations and the public can have trust in what they're getting. And I guess to this note, despite some heartburn, that it might give some of our friends at the agency, I would be remiss if I didn't note that this same group of dispensary owners is awfully excited about the opportunity to have a soft start in the recreational market through the medical programs early on. If that is all at all a possibility, I think you start to see that you set the table for the recreational and the medical programs and how those two might be able to get along, if you will, as we move forward in the system. And it becomes a great transition point for the from the medical to the retail systems as well. So these are just a few of the pieces. Really excited to be in this conversation with you all. We have been waiting for the rec conversation and so glad it's here. Thank you.
Great. Questions, Representative Buckley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to offer my beleaguered staff's services, if it's okay with the committee, to work on a edibles amendment and a backup PRF section as well, if that's of interest to the committee.
You know, I think that sounds great. I think Representative Hellam is also doing some work on edibles, so maybe
we can work together.
Okay.
Anybody else want to join on that?
Thank you both.
Wonderful. Did you want to note anything about edibles?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. This has been a really interesting area to look into, the edibles area, and I've been reviewing a little bit of the regulations from Colorado. I think we all came in here, and I think, Madam Chair, you and I even co-sponsored a bill giving the agencies additional time to do this. In looking at where the industry already is, and the sources of model regulation that we can borrow from Colorado, I'm not seeing the need for that. I think that this industry is, you know, as far enough advanced as any other part to be part of the rulemaking along with everything else that our agencies will be looking at. So I think I would agree at this point there's no reason to leave them behind.
Well, great. Any other thoughts on that subject? Okay, great. So we have Mr. Johnson, and then we have Bradley Steinman and Lucas Littlefield still. So I want to make sure we get to you in our remaining time. Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Anthony Johnson, today representing New Approach Oregon, the PAC responsible for the Measure 91 campaign. I join in the sentiment that I'm so glad this committee is moving on to Measure 91. And we wholeheartedly agree with the statements made by the ACLU earlier, and I wanted to touch on a few aspects of that briefly. ACLU is exactly right. The Measure 91, apparently it represents Bolson too. The Measure 91 measure, the campaign team, I would say the voters that voted with over 56% of the vote, wanted to stop treating marijuana use as a crime, wanted to treat it substantially similar to how we do beer and wine. And I commend you for looking to reduce marijuana penalties even further. And I look forward to working on an expungement provision as well. And also a big priority of the campaign, voters, I would say the state, I would say the federal government, is that we bring as many people into the regulated system as possible. Having a patchwork system where we have wide swaths of the state without regulated stores, I think, goes against the priorities of the state, the federal government, and the voters. And so I commend you for really clarifying the intent of Measure 91 with your local control provision in this dash one amendment. So I want to thank you for that. We also join in some concerns with the residency requirement in the measure. I think those are in sections 12, 14, 15, and 16. In addition to the constitutional issues, there's some practical issues about forcing everyone listed on the application to be a two-year resident. Currently under OLCC licenses, they have to list, licensees have to list everyone with like a 10% ownership in the measure. Also, they have to list their landlord. So I think there's like a little drafting that can be done to ensure that mom and pops can get the investment they need from you know, relatives from out of state investors who want to invest in Oregonians. So I think something more similar to what we have for medical marijuana dispensaries today can suffice. And you can go further to make sure everyone that is a major investor or owner has to undergo the same background check so we can make sure we're, the system is secure as well. Additionally, Section 18, which allows the OLCC to deny, like, certain activities at the same location. Measure 91 wanted to have, you know, a vertically integrated system as much as possible, and I think that system works pretty well. I think to match the intent of Measure 91, some language that the OLCC may deny certain applications for the benefit of public safety, I think, could be added to just clarify that it doesn't stop people from being as vertically integrated as possible, and it's more a safety consideration that you don't need, you know, say, butane being processed next to a kitchen or things like that. So, but overall, I think this bill is a great start, and I look forward to moving forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you. May I, does anyone have a question for the panel? I actually would love to get your feedback on an idea that I heard from someone who's working in the Colorado sector about residency requirements. And this is just generally throwing it out to the room, but Anthony, since you mentioned residency, I'd love to get your thoughts on it. The person I spoke with noted that it might have been better, or it might be better, as we do our work, instead of having a residency requirement, to do a thorough background check, because the thing that we're trying to get at is the investor someone who is either, you know, engaged in some out-of-state drug activity, so they're going to divert the product to out-of-state, which we can't do under the Cole memo, or are there resources from some illegal activities somewhere else in our state or out of our state or even out of our country, but that maybe we could get at that by imposing a pretty substantial background check, maybe only allowing investors who are individuals, not shell entities, so that we could really know who's investing and if people check out in that regard, then deeming it fine for our work. How does that sound just off the top of, just as a first respond?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, at first glance or first hearing this, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that transparency is the best way to go, and you don't want to have situations where people are hiding money or where it's coming from. Let's bring everybody into the open, into the transparent, regulated system, and I think that's a good start.
Anybody else have any thoughts on that?
I still hold that we need to have a one of the Cole memo, more control of who's coming into the process, at least in the beginning. And I think what we've talked about is on the residency, we've dropped it to 2 years and then having it sunset sometime shortly after that. At least we have the control of getting the industry up and going without having the concern. The background check is to be an intense background check. I'm not sure what that really means or how that's going to be. Representative Olson knows that when they do a background check on someone going in law enforcement, you're going to be going around the country potentially looking into people. And so I don't think we're going to have the resources to do that type of extensive background check.
Okay. That's a fair point. The person who suggested it noted that we could have the investor have to pay for the cost of the background check, which was an interesting. But this is for more conversation later. And Andy, Representative Olson, did you want to say
something? I was just checking to see if Nikki needs some water. She looks like she's about ready to die.
Emergency response team.
Wants edibles in there.
All right, then. So thank you, panel. And we have our last witnesses for the evening, Bradley Steinman and Lucas Littlefield. Hi, welcome.
Hi. I guess I'm going first.
Okay.
For the record, I'm Bradley Steinman from Portland, Oregon. Chairs, members of the committee. I am here to talk about, one, why are we calling it recreational marijuana? That's just not required by Measure 91. It invites federal preemption. It's not reflective of the will of the voters. Recreational has a negative connotation to it, and it's going to be federally preempted. We should be talking about the responsible adult use of cannabis And also, wherever we can, to use the word cannabis instead of marijuana, which has a really bad racist history associated with it that you can read about in plenty of places, and it's, you know, accurate. It was used as a propaganda tool to get the law passed in the first place in 1937. Second, we should have a single state agency regulating cannabis. OLCC is... they've developed an expertise in what they're supposed to do and what they've been required to do for the last 100 years since alcohol prohibition ended under the 21st Amendment, which is to regulate alcohol. And cannabis is like alcohol, but it's not alcohol. They're different things entirely. And marijuana actually has medical value, which our state has recognized since 1998. So I think that the single state agency can be done in the definition sections. I think that HB 3400, Section 5.1 invites it. They nixed the definitions for Department of Agriculture, for Commission, for the Oregon Health Authority. And in my mind, that just smacks of we should have a single state agency. Anytime it mentions any of those things, it should be the Oregon Cannabis Enforcement Authority. Some sort of agency that's charged with regulating the industrial uses of hemp, the medical use of cannabis, and the OMMP program, MMDP program, the OHA's dispensary program, and all of the things that really relate to the same plant, which is cannabis. And, you know, it's going to be a distraction for OLCC, quite frankly, from their primary task, which is to regulate alcohol. And they're not going to be able to pay full attention to what, you know, the left hand's going to be doing. The right hand's not going to know, and it's going to be a big mess. Three agencies, three times as difficult. I think it's possible. It's what Measure 91 has in there, but I certainly think it could be improved, and I hope that y'all consider that. Next, that kind of flows right into sales for July 1st. We already have a medical marijuana dispensary program, which was, the result of HB 3460. They have four employees right now, I believe, and certainly that's not enough to regulate the entire rollout of the responsible adult use program, but I believe that with a little, you know, effort, with the time that we have left, and we certainly have time before July 1st, we should be creative about what's the most logical and beneficial thing to do for Oregon moving forward and for this industry and for the medical program. There's a huge backlash from folks in the medical program about being regulated by the OLCC, and understandably so. I think the OLCC just does not have any idea of what they're doing, and they're grasping at straws, and they're embarrassing themselves.
Okay, thank you. Just to be clear, I think in the 964 bill, medical program is under the Oregon Health Authority, but I know that there are some tensions, and that was one of the reasons why we put it under the Oregon Health Authority.
It was already the medical marijuana program has been under OHA for a little while now. It wasn't always there. That's something that you have to talk to Przanski and Buckley about.
Well, thanks so much for your comments. Mr. Littlefields.
Co-Chair Leninger and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here today. Sorry I was a little late getting to the work session today. I've got a few quick points that I'm actually dovetailing off of what I heard today in testimony. One clarification I'd like to make and have it on record is that marijuana is not medicine. Medicine is defined by the FDA and typically is a trademark item. Marijuana is medicinal, arguably, but it is not a medicine. So just keep that in mind as we move forward that we're not dealing with medicine as of yet. It's not a prescribed substance. Secondly, there is still, even though Colorado has established a suggestive dose, there is not an established dose of marijuana as far as research has provided at this point. There are 295 cannabinoids produced by the plant, and within a, let's say, a 10-milligram dose, any of those cannabinoids could or could not be present. Different cannabinoid profiles are what provide the different effects of cannabis. So when we're thinking about establishing or regulating a dose, just keep in mind that, and thank goodness we've got some research provisions in this bill, we do need more research before we can clearly establish what a dose truly is. So again, just something to keep in mind. I'd like to preempt this comment with an ask. I'm in no way speaking against folks who have found medicinal benefit from the plant or from any of its derivations. But at this point, I feel, from my experience in the industry and my experience with the research, that there is a high level of self-medication going on. If folks were, let's say, to have free access to narcotic medication and be able to use it whenever they felt like it, folks may think they need to use more than they do. Tolerance issues come into play, and potential other issues with engaging in the body system. What I'm getting at is, when folks speak about how much they may or may not need to use, my strong feel from a research perspective is that they may be a little off. And from working with over 4,200 patients with MX Biotech, we found out that a microdosing approach is actually much more beneficial than a macro or high-level dosing approach. So again, just some food for thought as we move forward into the scientific application of this substance. I would like to say that I really appreciate the testimony of Ms. Nato about the propagation language and the research being in the bill, and thank any and all legislative folks who are involved in getting that language in there. We as MX Biotech have been in support of cannabis research for a while now, and so we feel that that research being part of that bill is very, very important. So thank you for that. And in closure, I really would like to say that regardless of the background of where you folks came from into marijuana, you're doing a stand-up job. Every member of the committee, I feel, is come above and beyond what I expected the legislature to come up with as far as cannabis regulation and application. So regardless of some potential negative emails and phone calls that you may have been getting, I think you folks are doing a very stand-up job, and I really appreciate all your time. Thank you.
Lovely. We may invite you to close every one of our meetings, Mr. Littlefield. Does anyone on the committee have any closing thoughts for this evening? So I'm going to pass out to members of the committee just a list of the changes as I kind of remembered them that people had mentioned in our last meeting. And I'll try to do an inventory of what I heard, some of the key concerns that I heard people raise in this meeting as we try to make sure we capture them and are able to talk through them and figure out how to move forward. But I suspect that our next bit of work is going to be doing some revisions and drafting and some work sessions in small groups where we try to talk out some issues. And if anyone has a small group topic that you want to be part of or initiate, you know, holler. And we're going to keep on working. And we'll post, hopefully, another hearing or some kind of informational session for this coming Monday. But I'm going to wait to confer with
Wednesday.
Co-Chair Burdick. I'm sorry, not this Monday. This coming Wednesday because of Memorial Day.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
On reflection of the invitation for a comment, I'd like to make one.
Okay.
Or two.
Sure. We've got a comment here from Senator Farrelly.
The consternation I'm hearing about what may occur in a regulated producer environment, whether that's for medical or personal use. I'm trying to be sensitive to the other issue. There's a different paradigm when you are asking for a license than possibly in another circumstance where you're just an ordinary individual and you have a home grow. And there are unquestionably trade-offs that are made when you ask for a license relationship with an authority like the state. And talk to any business entity that's licensed. It's a rare person that doesn't have a criticism about the licensure relationship and the licensure responsibility that are imposed upon people, from folks that run nail salons to folks that run auto body shops to, you know, just virtually anybody in business has a regulatory framework. We're asking a whole bunch of folks who have not experienced a regulatory framework to come into a regulatory framework. And it is going to be, there's going to be some disconnect and there's going to be some whiplash from that process. And I think we should anticipate that. Those folks that are going to be put into a regulatory role need to understand there's a potential difference between a consultative role the regulatory role. And you know, we've had a lot of success in state agencies where people starting with a new license don't get fined or ticketed. They get counseled. So, you know, I'm going to just emphasize that, you know, we're asking a whole bunch of people to enter into a licensure relationship that have never been in one, they are going to feel invaded. There's no way there's not going to be that kind of a sense. But how the agencies conduct themselves in that relationship, whether it's a enforcement role, which you know might be pretty abrasive, or a consultative role, which might in fact be educational, and how that rolls out will be the difference for success or failure in lots of these relationships. So you know that I think is the one thing that I responded to when people were talking about what it's like to have a family farm and to hear the crunch of boots on the gravel in the driveway without having gotten a call to let them know that you were going to be inspected as a grow operation. But if we're going to look at reasonable regulation, then the folks that have a license have given permission for the inspection. That's the piece that's getting missing here. You know, if you want a license, you're giving permission for the inspection. If you don't want the license, you won't have the inspection. So, you know, that I think is something that we need to spend some time helping people to understand. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's enough sermonizing for this evening.
Just the right amount, but there's room for more.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. I've had a 40-year relationship with the FCC, and they never call before they drop by.
That's my point.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for a good meeting, and it's hereby adjourned. For a good meeting, and it's hereby adjourned.